Hi everyone and welcome to Téngase Presente. My name is Marcos Falcone and I would like to greet our English-speaking audience for a special episode of a podcast that is, of course, almost always in Spanish. Today, I'll be interviewing Deirdre McCloskey, who many of you probably know already, even if only because 2 years ago I did the same. So Deirdre is one of the most renowned classical liberal intellectuals of the world and is now a distinguished scholar at the Cato Institute. What we care about is what she has to say about the relationship between freedom and wealth, particularly in a poor country like Argentina. Let's listen to her. Welcome, dear Deirdre. It is an honor to have you here. I keep seeing new recognitions for you. You might remember we actually met last year in Mexico for Caminos de la Libertad. And now in 2022, you joined the Cato Institute as an Adam Smith Fellow. So my first question is, what are your own thoughts on being recognized for your work? What have you achieved or what are you achieving that others are not?
Well, I don't want to say that others are not, but I finally arrived at what I call humanomics, which is economics with the humans left in. And I do not mean that by that behavioral economics, which I don't have a very high opinion of. No, it's an economics that recognizes that we're human beings and that we talk, which is a long time theme in my work, and that we have understanding and opinions and expectations in a way that the Austrian economists speak of. So I've become kind of an Austrian economist.
Interesting.
And I think this is why the world grew rich. Liberalism, I mean, my argument is, and I think my main scientific achievement in my career is to show over the last, 20 years that ideas, the humanities, novels, plays, philosophy, history, determine how people behave in the economy. So what the ethics that you learned at your mother's knee is fundamental and is continuously modified in our cultures by the conversation in our cultures. I'm very excited about this idea. And as I say, it's been gradually getting clearer in my mind, slowly, decade by decade. So that's my chief scientific and political achievement.
So you sent me, so that I could prepare for this interview, a forthcoming paper called Liberalism Caused the Great Enrichment, which you were just talking about. And I know economists, as well as political scientists, are usually very skeptical of stating something like that with so much confidence. So what is going on here? What drove you to state that conclusion so strongly to the point that it is literally in the title?
Well, I'm a follower of John Stuart Mill in two ways. I'm a 19th century liberal, as he was, but I also follow him in scientific methodology. He wrote a book in the early 1840s called A System of Logic, which I read when I was a graduate student. And what he says, and he also says it in his much more famous book on liberty, 1859, he says, look, ideas, truth, to be more exact, will be achieved by honestly facing up to the arguments that our opponents are making. That's contrary to the way most science and scholarship works. Most science and scholarship, the person states her theme and doesn't deal with the objections to her theme. Now, I've written three books, which I call the Bourgeois Trilogy, very grand name, where I'm repeatedly following Mill's advice to look into the other arguments for economic growth and the development of freedom in the modern world. And so by rejecting them, not just saying, oh, they're all wrong, I hate them. No, that's not the point. to show factually that they're wrong. Neo-institutionalism, for example, is wrong. That then leaves me with the conviction that ideas mattered much, much more than most of them, social scientists have been prepared to admit since Marx.
So why is neo-institutionalism wrong exactly, or why do you not have a high opinion of behavioral economics, for example, which you were talking about earlier?
Well, I have a book that came out this spring from the University of Chicago Press called Against Behaviorism, and it lays out the argument against neo-institutionalism and against behavioral economics. Both of them are behaviorist in the sense that the psychologists thought was a fine idea in the 1930s, rat running, so to speak, experiments in which you provide the rats with incentives, food, and then you see how they behave. And that, this outside view of humans is what I'm against in advocating for humanomics. This idea that all we know about people is what they do, what we can from the outside view them as doing. And that's true of behavioral economics. It's true of neo-institutionalism, which is old friend, great and flawed Douglas North said, the rules of the game, the external rules of the game. That's what economists think they have to do. And I'm saying, no. You're allowed to understand what people are saying, for example. You're allowed to consider that Argentinians, for example, are utterly persuaded that the government should run their lives. And that's a new thought, actually not that new in Argentina, about 100 years old. And that changes the way the Argentinian economy and politics works. So it's in an odd way, it's a combination of what a long time ago I wrote about the method of economics back in the 1980s. I was writing about the so-called rhetoric of economics. And it's bringing that insight that economists are humans, that they use metaphors and arguments from authority, that sort of thing, into the economy. Now, this is my friends in the 1980s and 90s said, of course, that's what's true. The economy itself works on people's understanding. And I resisted that for a long time. But in the last 20 years, I've come to see that it's the secret sauce, as I call it, or the spring that gives motion to the modern world.
So you have another paper called How Boring People Made Us Rich, funny title. And I wonder, is this what makes liberalism so effective? If I'm not sure if we're talking about ideas or not anymore, but the fact that if we embrace liberalism, then we don't need great leaders or marvelous central planning to prosper?
That's a very interesting point and is expressed much more clearly than I have. Yeah, that's right. Liberalism is boring like Zurich in Switzerland is boring. The Swiss are boring. The Argentinians are very interesting and exciting and dancing the tango. Yeah, and that's both the advantage of liberalism because, you know, it's easy to be boring. Just mind your own business and, you know, work hard and invent stuff, be creative. Whereas, as you said, the interesting stuff is the man on the white horse, like Donald Trump or Bolsonaro or Hitler. Oh, we'll have a plan. We'll follow the economic ideas of Raoul Prebisch and we'll erect protectionist tariffs around Argentina, and boy, that'll really be great. These interesting, exciting ideas are mostly wrong. So that's the kind of public policy thing about it. But on the politics, there's a problem because boring is boring. And it's always been the problem of this new liberalism, which was an idea in the minds of advanced intellectuals in the late 18th century and then was gradually implemented in the early 19th century in places like Sweden, or in the middle of the 19th century in Sweden, and has been under challenge for about 100 years by interesting, exciting ideas like communism and fascism and just regulation and central planning, industrial planning. And the problem is that John Stuart Mill type, we believe in free speech. We believe in listening to the other side. John Stuart Mill was famous for this. Though a great exponent of economics, he also, of free market economics, he also was a great sympathizer with the emerging ideas of socialism in the mid-19th century. And that leaves us unable to protect ourselves. Whereas the enthusiasts for these exciting and interesting ideas are willing to kill people to implement them. We're not.
So if we're talking about how countries grew rich, I was mentioning to you before we started the recording that I've spent the last 3 months here in the United States at the American Institute for Economic Research. And during my time here, one thing that I noticed, not right here, of course, but in academia in general, is that there are increasing attacks against rich liberal democracies on the grounds that they supposedly stole their wealth, either through colonization or slavery.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, if you mean, does their claim make sense? Of course, I think, no, it doesn't make any sense. But if you mean it's increasingly popular, yeah, it does make sense. For example, the King Cotton School of American History, as I call it, in the last dozen years or so, has put forward the claim that slavery was central to the coming of what they call capitalism to the United States. And their argument is that cotton cloth is fundamental. The making of cotton cloth is fundamental to the Industrial Revolution, which itself is not a very good phrase. And that depended on raw cotton from the United States, which is also false. And that cotton cultivation depended on slavery, which, by the way, is also historically false. So slavery causes capitalism. And the left has been trying to show this, and actually parts of the right too, for a couple of hundred years. They've been trying to find the original sin in what I call innovism, as a word that's much better, much more sensible scientifically than capitalism. But anyway, they, my friends, my dear friends, I was once a Marxist myself, my dear friends on the left still believe this, that there's something so evil about markets that there must be some sin that caused it. Marx himself somewhat strangely said it was piracy in the 16th, 17th century that caused it. The original accumulation of capital is another hypothesis. And then slavery. Then imperialism, the last stage of capitalism, as the hero of my youth, Lenin, said. So we, whoever it is, didn't get rich by stealing from people. Not from slaves, not from colonies, not from the colonialism of free trade, which the Argentinians believe in. None of that's true. We got rich by being ingenious, by thinking up new ideas for divided highways or containerization, antibiotics, new ways of building houses, hybrid corn, and so forth. That's its ingenuity, and therefore that's why I call the modern world innovism, because it's innovation that made us rich, not grabbing from other people. And, you know, there's just massive evidence that this way of looking at it, my way, is more or less the correct way. Does it strike anyone as reasonable that stealing from poor people is a good plan to make yourself rich? If you're going to steal from France. don't steal from Uganda. Come on. So in no way is the statism of imperialism, of having empires, a smart way of becoming rich.
In that regard, do you think the U.S. is still the country that other countries should look up to in order to prosper?
Well, certainly not in our recent politics, which is vicious and hateful, full of hate. We Christian liberals, above all, have a gospel of love, not a gospel of hate. So the hateful attitude that both the left and the right have about each other in the United States, which is very deep in my country. It's Americans, right from the beginning, from the 1776 on, have been frightened of each other and hateful towards each other. And it's very deep in American history. So I certainly do not recommend that. On the other hand, I do recommend, to some extent, in some respects, the United States is the chief modern example of the successes of liberalism, by which I mean non-slavery. Now, that's, you know, we had slaves until 1865, so, you know, we're not we're not pure in this matter by any means. And we had segregation, and we still have it, and blah, blah, blah. So we're not a perfect example of liberalism. But as people, as thinkers in the 19th century, such as Tocqueville in France, noted, the United States is the great example of a successful free country, free-ish, not completely free. And he contrasted it very interestingly in his book, Democracy in America, with both Russia, on the one hand, which he regarded as the great, now this is in a long time ago, he saw this as the great example of a non-free country. And then in his book in the 1850s, the old regime in his own country, France, he contrasted the United States with the centralization of France. So yeah, there's some good, admirable things to be learned from American history and some horrible, evil things to be avoided.
When I first interviewed you in October of 2020, we had a presidential race going on in the U.S., and you were worried back then that Donald Trump had authoritarian ambitions and therefore said that you were going to vote for Joe Biden for president.
Which I did.
So what are your thoughts on the new president?
Well, he's been in lots of ways very, very successful, even though from the right, from the sort of Fox News right, from the crazy right, he's viewed with alarm. And from the more sensible liberal position, such as the American Institute for Economic Research, he's viewed as, oh, he's another one of these statists. He's a left, not left wing, but a moderate Democrat. He's going to bring more regulation, and that's bad. And I agree with the view of the American Institute that I wish he wasn't such a statist. For example, he hasn't removed the protectionist and anti-immigration policies that Trump introduced. And this I regard as terrible, but I don't regard it as a constitutional catastrophe. And it's constitutional catastrophe that I'm trying to avoid. I think all this is very well illustrated by what's going on in Ukraine. It's not left versus right that's at issue here. It's tyranny versus freedom. Now, maybe in the long run, Ukraine will not prove to be a wonderful example of a free society. I hope it will be, but right now it's so obvious that it's Putinesque tyranny against a country that's trying to be liberal. And I think that Joe Biden, but by the way, one of the things I like about Joe Biden is that he stutters. I'm a stutterer. I always have been, although as I get older, it improves. And he's wonderfully charitable and good about when he encounters someone who stutters, he tries to help them. And that's the opposite of Donald Trump. Donald Trump is a monstrous person And, you know, he's fortunately, he's not as smart as either Hitler or Mussolini. Keeps screwing up his the kind of support he could get if he were a more ethical person.
You were just mentioning Ukraine, and I wanted to ask you, if we switch from the U.S. to the rest of the globe, do you think the world is in a better place now than it was 2 years ago, for example, in terms of liberties?
Yes, not 2 years ago, 6 months ago. When the war started in Ukraine, when the invasion started, and when the Ukrainians showed that the Russian army is a paper tiger, opinion worldwide in favor of liberalism was reminded, so to speak. You know, there's this kind of sloppy tendency, which one sees in Argentina and the United States and Britain and France and all the others, to keep expanding the power of the state. And the Ukrainian war, although, you know, war is the specialty of states, of governments. So, you know, it's not always going to work out that war is going to be the way forward. This kind of war, it is, for example, the war that Britain undertook against Hitler alone is, as it's often portrayed, although that's not quite true, but in late 1940, again, it was completely clear that Britain was the light of freedom in the world, and Hitler was the darkness. So I think things are worse than they were before Donald Trump and Bolsonaro and so forth came on the scene, Orban in Hungary and so forth. And indeed, the catastrophe from the left in Venezuela. But there's hope.
So you believe we're still likely to expand our spheres of liberty and improve our standards of living worldwide?
Well, here's why. The demonstration effect, you might call it in an academic phrase. It's so clear that leaving people alone in the economy works. Hong Kong was the old example of this after the war, after the Second War. In 1948, Hong Kong was just as poor as the mainland, unspeakably poor, $2 a day. Now, although Xi Jinping is in process of wrecking it, Hong Kong's income per head is almost equal to that of the United States. And the formula was very simple. Enforce laws in a fair way and leave people alone. And that message, not counter policies or anything like that. I have an essay called The Near Impossibility of Policy, which argues against having any kind of policy except laissez-faire and a hand up to the poor and handicapped in a Christian way. That has worked so well. And if we can persuade people that the way forward for any country you want to name is to leave workers and entrepreneurs alone, essentially, there'll be a universal birth of freedom. I think liberalism is the end of history.
Wow. I had a couple more questions, but I think this is a good time to stop and let our listeners reflect. So thank you, Deirdre, for this interview and for, you know, granting me this opportunity.
Well, I've enjoyed it, dear.
I did have more questions, but when we got to that point, I was like, there's no way we're ending higher than this. So here we are. I think Deirdre's consistency in terms of her values and the implications of her thought is admirable. And this is the reason why I love talking to her. So I hope you enjoyed this episode as well. Thank you all for listening. If you're an English-speaking listener and are afraid of Spanish, do subscribe to the podcast on whichever platform you use. I promise you, it's not that terrible. We'll make you feel at home. And to the regulars, I say thank you again for joining me, and we'll be back next week for a Spanish-speaking episode of Téngase Presente. Bye-bye.